This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
One in three American young people will be arrested before the age of 23, and many will spend time in institutions that used to be called reform schools or rehabilitation camps, but can really only be described as prisons.
What people don't realize is that, you know, a lot of people are saying this, but we're locking up kids we're mad at, not just kids we're scared of.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the author of an extensive study of the juvenile justice system and learn just what is happening to children behind bars. We'll also spend an academic minute looking at the health care people get while they're in jail. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. When a young person is in trouble and is sentenced to serve some time, the picture many people have is a reform school where they're counseled and guided to find a better path. In reality, they're sent to prison with all of the nightmares of the adult prison culture, including violence and sexual abuse. In her new book, Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison, Nell Bernstein paints a bleak picture of a juvenile justice system that she says seems more interested in punishing children we're mad at rather than afraid of. Nell Bernstein is an acclaimed journalist and author whose work has appeared in Newsday, Salon, Mother Jones, and The Washington Post. She is a former Soros Justice Media Fellow and winner of the White House Champion of Change Award. We spoke about her book, and I pointed out that I was astonished by the fact that one in three young people will be arrested before age 23.
It is an astounding number. On the other hand, the number that really surprised me was that 80 to 90% of all American teenagers in confidential interviews acknowledge committing an act serious enough to get them locked up. So in that sense, we're still very selective about who we're incarcerating.
What's the history of juvenile prisons in the U.S.? When did this get started?
The first institution specifically for children was the House of Refuge in New York in the 1800s. This preceded the invention of the juvenile court at the turn of the century in Chicago. I think there's a myth about the history, which is that we've moved from a rehabilitative system to a punitive or even abusive one over that period. When you look a little deeper at these early institutions, it turns out that many of the abuses that are happening today were endemic from the very start.
You follow some young people in your book. Tell us about them and where you found them. Where'd you get their stories?
Two different ways. I have worked with young people for 20 years. I edited a youth newspaper for a decade, mostly in the 90s, the height of the super predator era. So a lot of them are kids I've known for some time. And I was introduced to this issue really because my staff kept getting arrested. And I would follow them, you know, to court. And if that didn't work, to juvenile hall, and just learned more and more about what this system was doing to kids. I also went around the country and visited institutions and talked to young people, both in and out of them.
What are the main problems? And again, this is has to be a thumbnail here, but what are the main problems that are happening? What kind of abuses are you finding that people just don't know about?
You know, it's not hard to summarize the problem with incarcerating juveniles. The problem with incarcerating juveniles, especially in these large prison-like institutions, is incarcerating juveniles. There has never been a period where there were not physical and sexual abuses. And I think equally importantly, but less well known, juvenile incarceration is actually the best predictor there is, more relevant than, you know, family issues, drug issues, mental health, what have you. It's the best predictor of adult incarceration. It doubles the chance that a young person controlling for everything in the world will wind up in adult prison. So it's actually, you know, what doctors would call an iatrogenic intervention. It worsens the original problem.
And when you say young people, we're not talking about, you know, kids 13, 14 years old. This goes up to people in their mid-20s, right?
Well, you know, yes and no. If you're sent to a state juvenile prison, you can stay there until sometime in your 20s. It varies from state to state. But, you know, I interviewed one kid, a guy named Curtis, who was sent to the California Youth Authority which at the time was a vast and profoundly abuse-ridden institution at the age of 10. And I think that what people don't realize is that, you know, a lot of people are saying this, but we're locking up kids we're mad at, not just kids we're scared of. And when we do lock up a kid who has become violent or dangerous, almost without exception, you'll see a string of earlier incarcerations, starting generally with very low-level offenses, things like running away, stealing a pack of cigarettes.
Let me get two answers for this question about treatment that people, that young people go through when they're in a prison like this. What types of treatment or rehabilitation, for the lack of another word, is being given? And what kinds of treatment do people think are happening in there? Is it the same?
Well, if people think that anything rehabilitative is happening in the vast majorities of these institutions, then I'm afraid they are mistaken. Whether or not there's a program in a particular institution, the vast majority of them are, I think, what I would call dehabilitative. Kids say things like, thrown to the animals, I became an animal. A lot of animal imagery. I did visit several institutions that were trying very hard and with the best of intentions to shift towards a therapeutic modality, introducing therapeutic models inside their facilities. But what I found, to my disappointment, when I talked to the kids was that it really isn't possible to have the kind of trust and openness that you need for a real therapeutic relationship when either actually or figuratively the person leading your therapeutic group holds the key to your cell. And kids talked about, for example, having their sentence extended because they got write-ups for not telling their story in group the way that they were supposed to.
Are people doing things that are working?
They are. The thing that people are doing that is, I think, really transformative is they're sending kids home. There's been a 40% drop in the number of young people in these institutions over the course of a decade. In California, where I live, we've gone from more than 10,000 in our youth facilities to just a few hundred, which would have been inconceivable. And the evidence is so strong that, to put it simply, relationship rehabilitates, that I think any decrease in the isolation of kids is profoundly promising. There are also what people call the evidence-based interventions, things like multisystemic therapy, where a young person stays in his home or sometimes in a specialized foster home, and the whole family works very intensively with a caseworker who's available sometimes around the clock. And those interventions are showing very positive results, including with young people who have committed quite serious or violent offenses.
So they're not just being sent home and say, okay, see you later, good luck?
Well, it varies. But when you think about the fact, again, that 80 to 90% of our kids are committing delinquent acts, and when you think about the tremendous racial disparities that you see in terms of what might happen to my white middle-class kid and a poor black kid who's got police patrolling his neighborhood and practicing stop and frisk, you know, I think the important thing to understand that is that the best cure for juvenile delinquency is growing up. The vast majority of us are to some degree involved in delinquency, and those of us who just kind of get a pass grow out of it. It's not a kind of kid, it's a developmental phase. And once we understand that, it opens up all kinds of possibilities.
You're just saying that, I'm thinking about my misspent youth and, you know, okay,
bullet
dodged. What types of offenses are kids being sent away for?
Well, I think there's a lot of misconceptions about that. You know, once the kid is behind that razor wire and wearing that jumpsuit, the assumption is that he's a murderer or at best a carjacker. The truth is that the majority of young people behind bars are there for nonviolent, non-serious offenses, and about 40% of them are there for very minor offenses, things like running away, truancy, a probation violation, maybe a marijuana charge. So again, the idea of the super predator, which I think is still with us, is a far cry from who these kids really are.
when these kids go in, no matter what their age, what are they faced with in there in terms of the violence, the abuse, just the culture that they have to learn in there?
Well, it's a kind of odd combination of fear, the sense that something could happen to you at any moment, and often does. I mean, 1 in 10 kids are sexually assaulted by a guard. About 1 in 50 is sexually assaulted by another ward. That's a tremendous proportion of young people. About 1/3 suffer some kind of physical abuse or unnecessary force, again, at the hands of the people supposed to take care of them. So there's this pervasive sense that something really awful could happen at any moment. And kids have told me about being pepper sprayed point blank with foggers meant to clear a room, or being forced to kneel for as long as 2 weeks in handcuffs because their unit got in a fight. I mean, really horrific stories. But then beyond that, when you walk into these places, and in between these violent outbursts, there's this tremendous sense of boredom. I mean, you walk into the day room and it can be almost soporific. And if you compare that to the tremendous sort of energy and noise and robustness of any other environment where you have a number of young people, you realize just how much their spirit is being quashed by the simple fact of incarceration above and beyond the abuses.
Still to come, our conversation with Nell Bernstein, author of Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison, continues with a look at the role for-profit prisons play in the juvenile prison story. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1242. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Nell Bernstein, author of Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. Many communities around the country have contracted out their prison systems to for-profit correctional companies. I asked Nell if that had anything to do with the conditions young people face on the inside.
We are entering, well, we have entered, actually, the time of for-profit prisons. How has that changed it, or has it changed things at all?
Well, you know, it's definitely changed young people's understanding of what incarceration means. When they understand that people can literally buy stock in their incarcerated bodies, and they do understand that, and on top of that, they're going through an experience pretty much custom-made to strip them of individuality and humanity. You know, they're given a number, they're given a uniform. Their possessions are taken, their connections are severed. I think it creates a cynicism and two things, a lack of trust in authority, which is exactly the opposite of the value that I think we're trying to instill, and a lack of connection between what they did and their circumstance, which is also something that the penitentiary is supposed to instill. You know, somebody said it wasn't me. If the system was correcting anybody, we wouldn't have the recidivism that we do. So I don't think private prisons are the heart of the problem, but I do think they exacerbate it.
And you do make it clear in the book that we're not talking about, quote-unquote, reform school. These are prisons these kids are being sent to.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, we are talking about reform school because I didn't start out using the word juvenile prison. Nobody uses that word officially. Reform school, training school, boys academy, ranch. I mean, the number of euphemisms that we have is incredible. Just like we call solitary confinement protective custody, or my favorite, reflection cottages. But the more time I spent in these places. The more times I drove through the coils of razor wire and gave my ID to the guard and was searched and, you know, heard the clanging of the gates and saw these tiny cells and kids marching in rows of three with sometimes in what they call the chicken walk, where their arms are crossed and their hands are in their armpits. The more I felt that I couldn't use these euphemisms because they just didn't describe the reality.
Who else is talking about this? Who is advocating for these young people?
You know, that's a really great question and one that makes me hopeful. All across the country now, we have a movement that politicians from both sides of the aisle are calling the Smart on Crime movement. You know, it sparked the 40% drop. It's motivated partly by fiscal concerns, but also driven by very dedicated advocates, especially the families of young people who are incarcerated. I mean, if I were to start naming groups, I would never stop. But Justice for Families, which is entirely comprised of parents. In Louisiana, a group of parents shut down first the most abusive facility and then most of the system. So I think that there are a tremendous number of people now aware of this issue and working to do something about it.
And what can be done? What are the solutions to this?
Well, you know, my answer to that now is very different than it would have been before I began my reporting. I wrote a book a decade ago about children of incarcerated parents, and it ends with a chapter of recommendations for how to solve the myriad problems I describe. This book does not have that chapter because the interviews I did, the kids I knew, the institutions I visited, and the mountains of research that I made my way through left me convinced that reform was a dead end for two reasons. One is that the abuses I've described have gone on since the very first House of Refuge. All the evidence indicates that they're endemic to a locked institution away from the public eye with these tremendous power differentials. The second thing is that we have been reforming these places since the day the first one went up. There's a facility in Florida known as Dozier, which is a real horror show. They finally closed it in 2011 so that they could start digging up the bodies. And I think they've reached about 100 and are still continuing to try to find and identify the kids who died from beatings there. What I really was shocked to find, though, was that Dozier was investigated more than a dozen times, starting in 1908. And each time, these abuses were exposed, there were promises of reform, perhaps a brief period of implementation, and then inevitable backsliding. And you see that everywhere. So I do think that the 40% drop has to become a 50% drop and then a 95% drop. And the tiny percentage of kids who do pose a real danger may need to be physically contained, but I think they need to be in places like Missouri, where they don't have these big facilities. They have small, regionally based, locked facilities where the staff are just immersed in a culture of rehabilitation and relationship.
Well, we'll go to that because we talked about who is talking about this problem. Is there anybody listening? I mean, we live in a very punitive society now.
Yeah.
Is anyone interested in, yeah, let's make it better for those kids we put away?
You know, it's fascinating. I have to say, I expected a lot more pushback when this book was released than I'm getting. I think one thing that's happened is the net has been cast so widely over the past couple decades that a larger and larger proportion of the public has been touched. If one in three kids are arrested, that means there's a heck of a lot of parents out there who are experiencing this personally. I also think that we've reached a tipping point on the question of cost. You know, we're spending, in California where I live, it reached $225,000 a year to incarcerate a kid compared to 8,000 and something to educate that child. So I do think that there's a real sea change brewing. I'm hopeful.
Again, the name of Nell Bernstein's new book is Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. It's published by The New Press. Since the Affordable Care Act went into effect, people who spend time in jail are guaranteed some health care, sometimes for the first time. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. The Affordable Care Act helps to ensure prisoners and people who have previously spent time behind bars. Marcia Regenstein, professor of health policy at George Washington University, examines the effects the law may have on both the health and penal systems.
Jails, unlike prisons, typically house offenders who've been detained or arrested, but mostly for nonviolent crime. They're often people who suffer from mental illness or substance abuse and are picked up by the police. Counties, cities, and other localities are responsible for providing inmates with health care while they're in jail. However, most people who have spent time in jail are poor and lack health insurance. They're often released back into the community with some of the same health problems that got them into trouble in the first place. The federal health reform law known as the Affordable Care Act provides people who have spent time in jail with health coverage, often for the first time. My co-author Sarah Rosenbaum and I found that about 4 million people who had been in jail will be able to get coverage for disorders such as mental illness under the ACA. If left untreated, such conditions can worsen and can lead to another arrest. The analysis shows that an estimated 1 out of 6 people enrolling in the expanded Medicaid program have spent time in jail, and another 1 out of 10 people signing up for a health plan under the new Marketplace exchanges have the same history of a recent stay in jail. Better access to health coverage might help provide these people with the stability they need to stay healthy and out of jail. Our analysis suggests that the Affordable Care Act is an investment that could lead to better health, lower health care costs, and a lower risk of recidivism.
That was Marcia Regenstein of George Washington University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.